Tottenham story is this. It's time to change the situation if Tottenham want to change.
I love to win, mate. That's the main thing. Hopefully I can fulfil those dreams and aspirations of every Tottenham supporter.
And still Ricky Villa. What a fantastic run. He scored.
He's going to have a crack. He is, you know. Oh!
I'm loving big engines instead. Guess I'm a Spurs fan now then.
Well, hello everybody. Welcome back to the Tottenham Way podcast. Marcus Buckland here, eagerly anticipating what should be a nigh-on, possibly completely full-strength starting 11 at home to Brighton on Saturday. First time, I think, this season that Ange could have everybody to choose from. I'm sorry for Son that it all went wrong for South Korea the other day, but hopefully he can put his international misery aside and take out his frustrations on the likes of Lewis Dunk. Tom Barkley from The Sun is also here to run the rule over what we can expect, I think, based on last season, to be a very feisty fixture. You may recall back in April that both Roberto De Zerbi and Christian Stellini were shown red cards as Spurs very fortuitously beat Brighton. And I was speaking to a Seagulls mate of mine the other day who's still crying about the fact they put four past us in December and they want revenge for what they thought was daylight robbery in Tottenham back in April. So we will discuss that. We'll mention Johan Lang, the sporting director, who's been bigging up the academy. Tottenham's youngsters are doing extremely well at the moment. We're going to touch on Giovanni Lo Celso as well, who's been linked with a move away, and also the departure or the imminent departure of the commercial chief at the club. And you may think, well, that's not very interesting, but there's a couple of points to make about that. So, Tom, hello to you. We've got a lot to get through. And actually, first things first, just about Lo Celso, because it's been bubbling over and he frustrates me. You know, we've spoken several times on the podcast about players who really, if they don't make a mark after a year or two at a club, they're not going to make a mark. And then earlier this season, we saw the best of him once more. Then he got injured again. And now there is a chance, is there not, that he might be going to have a reunion with a number of other Spurs players who've congregated in a different part of the world.
Yeah, hi, Marcus. Yeah, the suggestion had been in the Turkish media that Galatasaray were interested in doing a last-minute deal from their point of view in this month. Remember, the Turkish window is open till February the 9th, which is Friday. So obviously Premier League teams could still sell, even if they can't bring anyone else in. But my understanding is that Gio Lo Celso will be staying at Tottenham this window. I know your points that you make about him being frustrating in terms of his injury record. I'm sure it's frustrating for all Tottenham fans when they know clearly what talent he is. I'm sure it's more frustrating for Gio than anyone else that he can't stay fit. And we're waiting to find out if he is back for the Brighton game after picking up what we believe is a hamstring injury against Burnley all the way back in January the 5th in the FA Cup. But my understanding is that he is likely to stay the rest of the season. And then obviously in the summer, I think he'll have 1 year left on his contract. And if he hasn't sort of proved himself by then, more from a fitness point more than anything else, because let's be honest, when he has played for Postecoglou, as we saw in the Aston Villa game and the Man City game, sort of back end of November going into December, he has a lot to offer this team. But if he hasn't done that by then, you would not be surprised if there was a move available to him if he moved on then.
Yeah, he could go and team up with the likes of Ndombele. Most of the Spurs players who've left recently seem to be heading towards that part of Turkey. On the subject of players not in the first team, but who are looking to make a mark, there's a lot of excitement, I know, around the club about the way the academy is playing at the moment under the director, Simon Davis. Great results. Johan Lang, I hope I've got, I still don't know if it's Lang or Lange. And we want it to be Lange so he can rhyme with Big Ange. But the sporting director has been bigging up not just the players who've been signed during the January transfer window, but the youngsters as well who are playing to a system now that is demanded by the club. If they're going to get into the first team, they need to know from a pretty young age what type of football they have to play. Do you sense, having been around the ground recently, that there's genuine excitement at the way the club is developing at all levels right now.
Yeah, for sure. Although it's intriguing because on the face of it, it couldn't be going any better in the academy. The PL2, the Premier League sort of two, which is the reserves in old money, albeit it's a lot more sort of important perhaps than the reserves once were, when it was just the reserves was more when the first team players who were out injured got some game time coming back. They're top of that league, 11 wins out of 11, so literally couldn't be doing any better. And then in the under-18s division, they're top of their league, which is split in the north and south of the Premier League to make the journeys be a little less onerous. So it looks like they're going great guns. There's loads of great prospects of which we can go through. But the strange sort of side of it is, despite all this perceived success, Ange Postecoglou in last week's press conference actually sort of suggested that they were nowhere near where he wanted them to be from an academy point of view, saying compared to their rivals, and they now consider their rivals to be pretty much any of the top teams in Europe, they're not in the same position where they have quite the same kind of production line. And he sort of credited Simon Davis as someone who's got a lot of experience and who is well aware of what they want to achieve. And it's interesting to see. I mean, to be fair, it wasn't that long ago that they were perhaps sort of not finding it as easy to keep hold of some of their young prospects. When you think of someone like Nonny Madueke, who's now playing for the Chelsea first team, obviously left for football over in Holland. But now they are keeping hold of their players and they're adding to them with some of the most exciting young talent in Europe. None more so than Lucas Bergvall, who I imagine we're about to discuss in a second.
Yeah, I mean, that is exciting. And Johan was saying he wants Tottenham to be the destination of choice for the young superstars. And the fact that Bergvall chose Spurs above Barcelona, for example, suggests that that is starting to happen. Could you just give us maybe three or four names amongst these youngsters? I'm intrigued that Ange still feels they're a long way from where they need to be, but maybe he's just making sure that Simon Davis stays on his toes. But give us three or four names to keep an eye out for, Tom.
Well, obviously, you know, as you mentioned, we've got Bergvall, and we've also got the Croatian sort of wonder kid, Luka Vucevic, who's not actually arriving at the club till 2025. That was a deal that was done last summer from Hajduk Split, where Ivan Perisic has gone back to, and he's actually just gone on loan to a Polish team to get more game time. So those two are the obvious ones who are coming in from the outside. But just within the academy, I mean, there's young Will Lankshear, who's 18, striker. He's got 11 goals in 11 games in those PL2 games. He was actually signed from Sheffield United 18 months ago for £2 million, which is, you know, that's not nothing at that age, and actually started life at Arsenal. But despite that, he's someone they're very excited about. Young Mikey Moore is the player that lots of people have been talking about for a long time. Signed a new contract in the summer, despite interest from other clubs. He's only 16, but when you watch him play, he's got such grace on the ball, such dribbling ability and vision. He's someone that is definitely someone they're excited about. I mean, to be honest, apparently the under-15s team as well is one to really watch out for as well. And then Jamie Donnelly, he's the one who's sort of just about breaking into the first team at the moment, albeit mainly due to, think of someone like Manor Solomon being injured at the moment, he'd probably take his place on the bench. But Donnelly came off the bench against Brentford the other day and made himself an instant hero, as I said the other day, when he cynically took out Neil Mopai straight away. But he's got four appearances now off the bench for Spurs' first team. Interestingly, he's played for the under-19s for both England and Northern Ireland, because I think he was born in Northern Ireland, so he's got that option going forward. But he's another one they're very excited about. And yeah, having spoken to a few people around the club about them, they are very excited about some of the prospects they've got going through. They do realise, like Ange Postecoglou has said, and you do wonder sometimes whether he's mainly saying that because he just wants to elevate everything. He doesn't want anyone to be showing any kind of complacency at all. It might not necessarily mean that the academy is in such a bad state. Clearly it isn't, but he wants to take him to the next level. But like I said, there's real excitement about some of these players, and the emphasis, the significance, the real reason for it all is to try and get players into the first team. As well as these teams are doing in their respective leagues, really that doesn't matter so much. It's more about being able to develop those one or two jewels for the first team, or players they can sell off to you know, aid their transfer budget in the long term. And they are really excited about a few of these players that could go on and do that.
Yeah, and of course, you look back at the start of the great period for Manchester United, and it was the development at the same time of several of those youngsters that led to the glory years. So, of course, despite what Alan Hansen once famously said, you win nothing with kids. Well, you do, because they can develop into fantastic players. Being a little bit of a pessimist, I always think, you hear about these wonderful young players, but are they going to develop? Now, Bergvall, by all accounts, is special, and he's got a very good background too. I believe his parents are very supportive. But what is it about this guy, from what you've heard, Tom, that makes everybody believe he is going to be a genuine superstar sooner rather than later?
Well, just look at him. I mean, both at what he looks like. I mean, he looks like a movie star. But also when watching his clips from a few things I've seen, I mean, instantly I was called to mind Jude Bellingham. I'll be honest. The way he's obviously got that height, but he's got that ability to retain possession and drive away from other players out of sort of tight corners, with that sort of acceleration and that power at such a young age. Just, I mean, I watched, obviously we've all watched Bellingham, but I watched Bellingham play for the England 21s a few years ago, and it very much reminded me of that. My colleague Ali Gold over at Football London spoke to his longtime sort of mentor, it sounds like, this guy called Peter Kisfaladi, who has worked with him since he was nine, who's now the sporting coordinator from the academy to the first team at Djurgård, and the team that are selling Bergvall to Tottenham. And on that note about what he looks like, you see, great quote saying he looks like David Beckham at that age, and all the girls are going to love him, which you could definitely concur with. But he has these sort of blonde bombshell looks. But he mentioned Dejan Kulusevski, obviously a fellow Swede, talked about how Kulusevski played a big role in convincing Bergvall to turn down Barcelona with a sort of 10 to 15 minute conversation at the training ground. But interesting on Kulusevski, he said Bergvall is quicker than him, which is exciting. Bear in mind, Bergvall is more of a central midfielder than a wide player, but that's something to be excited about, the pace. He talked about how, because obviously Barcelona, that's looked like where that looked to be the destination Bergvall was going to go to, but it sounds like the uncertainty over the manager position with Xavi, you know, set to step down in the summer, did play a bit of a role, whereas Postecoglou doesn't look like he's going anywhere soon. He certainly shouldn't be, from Tottenham's point of view. And Postecoglou hasn't promised him minutes, but said, you know, if you do the work, I will give you opportunities. So he sort of chose that option for those reasons, really. And he also in that piece, mentioned how he actually had trials at Man United twice, and Bayern Munich twice, and Juventus before. So you sort of wonder why that didn't happen. But having spoken to lots of players over the years and interviewed them, that is something that does seem to crop up regularly. And often there's a reason why they can't particularly sign them. It doesn't mean they don't want to at that time. But look, their losses looks to be Tottenham's gain. And we'll wait with bated breath over the next 6 months or so before he joins. And back to that interview with Lang, just to round it off, he did confirm that Bergvall is coming to compete in the first team straight away.
Yeah, that is exciting. So definitely a focal point when we head towards the start of next season. Just before we look ahead to the Brighton game, and I know we're both going to try and pick the starting 11 and this assortment of riches that Ange has at his disposal this weekend. Just want to ask you quickly about Todd Klein, and a lot of Spurs fans won't really know much of anything about him, and on the face of things, talking about the commercial chief at the club isn't all that exciting. But the thing that intrigues me, Spurs have done really well financially over the past two or three years. They're now officially the richest club in London. I mean, they've been one of the richest clubs in the world for a very long period of time. Todd Klein, who is an American, is leaving. He's going on gardening leave. And then I believe he's going to join Chelsea. And the one thing that just intrigues me is, why right now would you want to leave Spurs at the start of what looks to be a very exciting period? And he also says he's a stadium geek, and we've got the best stadium in the world. Why would you leave now to go to Chelsea? It doesn't quite make sense to me.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I can't speak for exactly his reasons, but from what's being reported, it suggests that he obviously was, as you say, the chief commercial officer at Tottenham, but it looks like he's going into a slightly different role at Chelsea, or he's expected to take over a different role when he goes to Chelsea, and it's sort of more of a senior business role. So perhaps a new position, a different kind of responsibility, maybe was attractive. It's interesting to talk line. I got to sit down with him with a couple of other journalists in South Korea in the preseason tour 2 summers ago. And he always came across as a really nice guy who's very well spoken. And you'd see him actually whenever coming to games. Bear in mind, he was on the board. So he is, as we say in Sun parlance, a bit of a bigwig at the club, or was anyway. You'd see him, you know, getting the train in amongst all the fans, which was interesting. I mean, there are other sort of people talking about what he was like as a person, but I can't really speak too much to that. You know, you speak as you find us. I found him very pleasant. He obviously, the sort of stick that will always be there to beat him with from his legacy was he was brought in to secure the naming rights for the stadium, which hasn't happened. And, you know, that's legitimate criticism. But it does sound like, all at the same time, when you consider Tottenham's commercial success in terms of, or financial success, back to what you were saying about Deloitte being the richest club in London, I do believe he took quite a lot of pride in that. So he must have played quite a role in that as well. So, yeah, an intriguing one. But perhaps it's just a different opportunity that he wanted.
Yeah, okay. Well, I've always been intrigued by the fact that it's now however many years and they haven't got the naming rights. And reading some quotes both from him and from Daniel Levy, you start to realise that it is a complicated process. They've got to get the right brand. It's got to last for a long period of time. And I think apparently actually just calling the stadium at the moment the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium is not a bad thing financially. But it is strange that hasn't been resolved yet. Anyway, he can go to Chelsea. Good luck to him. And how annoying, by the way, that they produced their best bloody performance of the season at Aston Villa. Don't let Poch go and get to both domestic cup finals. That would be a little bit painful. Now, in terms of this weekend, I'm looking forward to this one. I can't believe it was April of last year when Brighton turned up on a sunny day. Christian Stellini was in charge at that point for us following the departure of Conte. De Zerbi was being quite closely linked with a possible move to Spurs, but he was an angry man from the word go. As I said at the start of the show, both De Zerbi and Stellini were shown a red card. Brighton were the victims of a number of, I think, pretty harsh decisions. They had a couple of goals ruled out for offside. When you look at the stats, Tom, surrounding the game, though, you can understand why De Zerbi was doing his head in, not winning. They had 17 shots to Tottenham's 9. They had 65% possession and they made 557 passes as opposed to Tottenham's 299. So it's not that long ago we could remember the football that Spurs weren't playing back then. But I suspect this could be quite feisty again. And we've got Ange hopefully picking a very, very strong starting 11. And this again, I think I went too soon last weekend when Spurs dropped those points in the last minute against Everton. I said on the pod that I think that is the end of our title charge. Then Liverpool go and lose. So we're only 7 points off the top. You were mentioning to me before we started the recording that there are a number of home games coming up now that look winnable. So, OK, I'm going to backtrack already and say that maybe this is the start of Tottenham's possible title charge. Bearing in mind, all our rivals are going to have plenty of cup and European games over the next few weeks. Have I gone mad again?
Well, no, you haven't got mad. You've asked me about four different questions in one.
I have.
Start with the Derby onto the game, the strongest team that Ange can pick for the first time.
Let's start.
And the title charge. I mean,
let's start with a title charge. Are we? I know that the Optus stat the other day said that we've got 0.1% right. chance of winning the title. Where do you stand on that?
Well, so the other day, the Optus supercomputer in its AI wisdom apparently gave Tottenham as less than 0.1% chance of winning the title. Now, let's be honest, most fans and pundits think it's very, very unlikely, but I don't know. I don't think they'll win the league, as we've said throughout, but when you look at the fixture list, their next three games are at home. They're all winnable fixtures: Brighton, Wolves, and Crystal Palace. weirdly all 3 o'clock on a Saturday, having had the same thing against Brentford, which was a real quirk. I can't imagine the last time that happened. Obviously, the Chelsea game's been moved because of them being in the League Cup final. But, you know, once those four games are out of the way, I wouldn't be surprised if the gap was cut by quite a long way. You'd expect them to win pretty much all those games. And then what really comes down to is if they've got any chance of winning it, which is the same every year, let's be honest, you've got to win those tough fixtures. You know, they go to Villa straight away after that. That's a tough game, albeit maybe not as difficult as it once was, given their form recently. But the real crunch period is at the back end of April going into the start of May. They have 3 games in a row in the course of 15 days, home to Man City, home to Arsenal, and away to Liverpool. Now, 2 of them are at home. Man City, as we know, got a pretty terrible record at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, albeit having won in the FA Cup recently. They haven't actually lost to any of those 3 teams in the league this season. So there's no reason to sort of be scared going into those games. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility that they get some good results. I don't think overall they'll still win the league, but I wouldn't completely rule it out at this stage. And the reason more than any is the fact that he's got, as I said before, the first time I can think of this whole season, he's got all his big hitters. He can pick what we think to be his start best choice first 11. I think there's a few question marks over who he might go for because the sort of state of competition now in the squad is pretty exciting. But obviously, Son is due back on today. We're recording on Thursday from after his Asia Cup defeat. It looks like Bissouma should be okay after his African Cup of Nations stint and there's reports of malaria. Hopefully, he'll be all right. And obviously, at the start of the season, where he had pretty much a full-strength squad, they didn't quite have it like that because they were missing Rodrigo Bentancur, who, despite maybe a couple of not completely convincing performances of late, I would argue is in Ange's first choice starting 11.
Well, we will both name what we think is going to be the starting 11 in just a few moments' time. I touched upon De Zerbi, how he was an angry man at the Spurs game last season. He's obviously done a fantastic job with Brighton, and you've been doing a little bit of work as well with the club, looking closely at their progress. It's a team you've got affiliations with. I mean, they did have a shocking defeat at Luton a few days ago, but in general terms, where are they at the moment? Where's De Zerbi at, and how much longer do you think he's actually going to stay at the club? He's obviously an ambitious man who is coveted by a lot of big clubs, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, on the face of it, just when his name is being sort of talked about as possible Liverpool contender after Jurgen Klopp goes, or Barcelona, it looked like the team is struggling, as you mentioned, getting battered 4-0 at Luton, as much as we've sort of wised up to the fact that that's actually not that easy a fixture. Still losing that kind of game in that manner doesn't look great. But actually, from a points situation, they got 35 points from 23 games. Last season, they had 35 from 22 games. So it's not far off it. Finished top of a Europa League group that included former Champions League winners Ajax and Marseille. All right, Ajax aren't the team they once were, even with Jordan Henderson now, but that's still nothing to be sniffed at for a team that's never been in Europe before. And he's had a serious injury crisis to deal with. I mean, the likes of the players that were so key to him last year and are so key to this system, these wingers, Matoma, Solly March, a player that's completely underrated. He's been injured for a long time now. Dingra, who's still at the African Cup of Nations now with Ivory Coast going through, but has also had his injury problems. Ansu Fati, brought in from Barcelona, he's been injured as well. So he struggled with that. And what's kind of one of his issues this season, not to go too much into Brighton, but we all know what a fantastic job they've done of sort of finding rough diamonds like Caicedo, for example, and selling them off for absolutely massive profit. The question mark is how long can they continue that for? They'll back themselves to do it, but you know, you look at Southampton, they did it once. It's not easy to keep reinventing yourself in that way. And at the moment, there are times this season where they've had a bit of a mix between some veteran players who still have so much to offer, particularly off the pitch, you know, like Lallana, Welbeck, who's still a wonderful player on his day. Pascal Gross has had a fantastic season. But these are players all sort of over 30. And then a whole bunch of teenagers. I mean, Brighton is the place to be if you want to be a teenager and make your name in the Premier League. But there's not a lot in between. And I think that's part of the reason why you've seen a bit of this inconsistency. And, you know, someone like Evan Ferguson, who's been linked to Tottenham a lot over the years. Well, I say over the years, he's only 19. You know, from the outside, people think, oh, what an unbelievable prospect. And he is, and he probably will be one of the next cabs off the rank. But I'll be honest, he's not been having a great season. He hasn't even been starting that often. And when he has, he's looked way off it. So he seems to be having a bit of a dip at the moment. So that might sum it up. But having said all that, they're actually not doing that badly. And with De Zerbi in charge, it seems like, speaking to people who cover the club regularly, it's not any kind of struggles they may have had. It's not down to him. If anything, they're doing so relatively well because of him. So I, like I did back then, you know, when we're talking about possible successors to Conte, I still have a very much a belief that he is the man. And I would not be surprised, back to one of your questions, this summer, if that was the time where he were to move on.
Well, he is clearly an extremely talented manager. He's got some physical players as well. I mentioned Lewis Dunk, and I imagine those set pieces, the corners that Brighton will have at the weekend, they're going to look to put pressure on Vicario again. Love to know what Millie Jednak, the set piece specialist at Spurs, has been doing this week in terms of providing perhaps a little bit of extra protection for the goalkeeper, who, to be fair, I think actually coped with some of those Everton high balls in the second half pretty well. And let's not start to criticise him too much, because he's been a fantastic keeper. And all right, maybe the opposition have spotted a little bit of a weakness there. So now we get a chance to see how quickly Spurs can react to that and deal with the problem. Now, Tom, in terms of this starting 11, and you made a very good point a few moments ago that obviously this is just about the first time that Ange has had almost everybody available. Lo Celso, as we've mentioned, is out. We don't think that Manus Solomon is perhaps ready just yet, but he has got an assortment of riches at his disposal. But does he know what his best starting 11 is? Well, luckily for him, Tom, I do know. So I'll tell him right now. Actually, I don't know. I've got a few either ors. This is my suggestion for the starting team on Saturday. The defence, of course, takes care of itself. Vicario in goal, Porro, Romero. Van de Ven, who I read actually in at least one report today, is apparently quicker than Usain Bolt. I don't know if you saw that, but they've been measuring his speed over a certain period. Wow. And then comparing it to Bolt, and he's quicker. I mean, arguably he's the quickest. I think they're saying he could be the quickest defender in the history of the Premier League, which I would believe. I mean, my only concern every time he goes sprinting after a striker and gets there easily, I just keep thinking, oh, don't suddenly clutch your hamstring again, because it does put an awful lot of pressure on him. But he's absolutely sure. Fantastic.
If it was him versus Carl Walker, I'm not sure I'd be able to call it. But if he's really as quick as Usain Bolt, then maybe it's Mickey.
Yeah, maybe, well, we need to arrange a head-to-head between... Well, Carl Walker's got a few other issues to deal with at the moment, so we probably won't in the near future. Anyway, Van de Ven, he's fantastic. Udogi, I know he's had a couple of ups and downs of late, but I just love him. So that defence takes care of itself. Madison, obviously, in the midfield. I'm assuming that Sarr is now fit to start. Then, you know, I don't know whether Bissouma is ready. Obviously, the Bissouma that started the season gets into my 11 every single time. Bentancur hasn't been quite as good in the last three or four games. But I would, you know, if I am privy to what's going on, which I would be if I was picking a team, I would be inclined to give the nod to Bissouma to play against his former team and show them what they're missing. Up front, I mean, the fact that Richarlison, Tom, has been scoring so consistently means I think you've got to keep him in that central position. Play Sonny, if he's ready to go again from the word go, out on the left. And then on the right, would it be Kulusevski? Would it be Werner? Would it be Johnson? For me, Cooley's been a little off the pace of late. I do like Werner, but I think I might be inclined to start Johnson. So that would be my 11. How many of those get ticked into your team out of that lot?
And not far off all of them. And to be honest, you know, the Werner, Bentancur, Bissouma, Johnson, Kulusevski debate, which is basically two positions really, is really the only sort of debate I think you can have in this team. As you say, keeping back four, pick themselves. I mean that back four and that goalkeeper, I mean, how much would you estimate that to be worth now in the market?
A lot. That's
300 million has got to be up there. Wonderful defense. And then I was going to say maybe Bentancur as a six, but he hasn't really played in there. And I do still look back on just how brilliant Bissouma was in that first month or so of the season. So let's put him there. And I think, as much as I really like Pap Sarr, I think his energy and his sort of tactical awareness, to be honest, of where to be is a real asset. I just think Bentancur is such a classy player when he's playing well. So I'd be inclined to start him and Maddison, but you could easily make a case for Sarr. And then I'd probably go with Kulusevski, but not because I think he's overwhelmingly the obvious choice. I do think that right side, it's not like a weakness, but it's the position that could do with the most improvement, not necessarily with a new signing, but just I feel like those players could do with stepping up their game. I mean, Johnson's the obvious one who's obviously got his goal the other day against Brentford, but and has shown sort of fits and starts of what he can do and that absolutely electric pace that he's got. But I think there's a big amount of improvement that he's got in him, which could lend itself to him being the long-term choice. Richarlison, I'm now at the point where I just think he's actually a really good player, and I think I need to sort of rethink some of the things I've said before, and just the fact that he, like I said last time, he's always had technical ability, just hasn't always strung it together. It's not like he's been, you know, got a ceiling where there are things he can't do. He is able to do those amazing things, and now he's starting to string it together, and you can see with every passing game the confidence that's flowing through him. And those goals against Everton, particularly the first one, the second one is a lovely, lovely finish. But I think a lot of players could do that. I think the first one on his weaker foot, it's just, and I know it's almost like a natural kind of reactionary kind of finish as well. So he hasn't really thought too much about it, but just it's so such a graceful strike there. I think that just sort of underlines just how good a player he can be. And so, yeah, I definitely play him through the middle. And now Son coming back, he has to play such a, probably being their player of the season, although it's quite hard to pick between so many candidates. But yeah, he comes back in on the left. And if he plays like he did, anywhere near like he did against Newcastle those few weeks ago when he ripped Kieran Trippier to shreds, then Spurs have got one hell of a player on their hands again. So, yeah, I mean, it's just a lovely headache for Ange to have. But yeah, I'd probably be inclined with Kulusevski and Bissouma at this point.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't argue. If Cooley starts, that's great. And that's the key issue. It is a wonderful problem that Ange has. And let's see what he goes for. I'm just so pleased that I never questioned Richarlison. I mean, if you listen back to some of the recent podcasts, maybe I said the odd thing, but no, listen, he's starting to look the part. There's an interesting little article, actually. I can't remember where I read it, but earlier today, where, again, he's spoken quite openly about how he was in a dark place. He wasn't the real Richarlison for quite a long time, and people were noticing that. And he said, look, where I come from, we don't tend to go and discuss our problems and have therapy, et cetera, but I have done, it's worked, and I'm going to continue doing so. And clearly that's proving beneficial on the pitch as well. And I love his work rate. So well done, Richie. Keep it up. And Tom, you're absolutely right. This is the start of a critical period. I mean, there are those, and social media, you can read just about everything. Those who've been criticising the defence recently, I think not appreciating that the system Spurs are playing puts a heck of a lot of pressure on that back four, on the central defenders in particular. So of course, at times, it looks a little bit helter-skelter, but I think they're dealing brilliantly with that. So please, let's not have any criticism of Romero or Van de Ven. And, you know, equally now, I guess there'll be those, if Spurs don't string together a succession of wins, who go, oh, well, Ange's got his players back. This is not as good as everyone's saying. But, you know, I just want us to stay as positive as possible. We're in a great place. I keep harping back to the fact, listen, if you go back to April when Brighton came here, the game we've been speaking about, and okay, we won it, but it was another dispiriting afternoon in so many different ways. And you know, it was around about that time that we were beaten at home by Brentford and by Bournemouth too. If I'd said to you then, this would be the team now, this is the way we'll be playing, you know, everyone would just jump up and down in delight. So let's not have short-term memories. It's a crucial part of the season. I'm looking forward to it. You're going to be there, Tom. We'll have a reaction podcast after the game. I think that's about it for today, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. I think we've covered a lot of stuff. But yeah, I'm excited about the game. Tottenham-Brighton, obviously, it wasn't a great day for Spurs last time they played them. Brighton took them apart, to be honest, at the Amex. But as ever, particularly that last 10 minutes, you can't ever oil Spurs anything out when it comes to Tottenham. And every time you watch them, particularly as a neutral, it's just a match that is a pleasure to be at. So I think that'll be full of incident, full of things to unpack after the game. So I look forward to doing it with the other boys after the game.
Yeah, Dan Kilpatrick from The Standard will be there, of course. I presume Tom Allnut of The Times will be as well. But thanks to Tom Barkley from The Sun. Thank you for listening. I am Marcus Buckland. As always, come on, you Spurs.